Chapter 42. Horrible cloud of flies, which he actually managed for an instant to leave behind him. But it was not from the cruelty of insects that he was flying, for no man could hope to drop that escort, and Jaffer in his life of a faithful messenger had been accustomed, if such an extravagant phrase may be used, to be eaten alive. Bent nearly double, he glided and dodged between the trees, through the undergrowth, his brown body streaming with sweat, his firm limbs gleaming like limbs of imperishable bronze through the mass of green leaves that are forever born and forever dying. For all his desperate haste, he was no longer a fugitive. He was simply a man in a tremendous hurry. His flight, which had begun with a bound, and a rush and a general display of great presence of mind, was a simple issue from a critical situation. Issues from critical situations are generally simple, if one is quick enough to think of them in time. He became aware very soon that the attempt to pursue him had been given up, but he had taken the forest path, and had kept up his pace, because he had left his Raja and the Lady Amada beset by enemies on the edge of the forest, as good as captives to a party of Tenga's men. Bellarup's hesitation had proved too much even for Assam's hereditary patience in such matters. It is but becoming that weighty negotiations should be spread over many days, that the same requests and arguments should be repeated in the same words, at many successive interviews, and receive the same evasive answers. Matters of state demand the dignity of such a procedure, as if time itself had to wait on the power and wisdom of rulers. Such are the proceedings of embassies, and the dignified patience of envoys. But at this time of crisis Assam's impatience obtained the upper hand, and though he never departed from the tradition of soft speech and restrained bearing, while following with his sister in the train of the pious Bellarup, he had his moments of anger, of anxiety, of despondency. His friendships, his future, his country's destinies were at stake, while Bellarup's camp wandered deviously over the back country, as if influenced by the vacillation of the ruler's thought, the very image of uncertain fate. Often no more than the single word "ood" was all the answer vouchsafed to Assam's daily speeches. The lesser men, companions of the chief, treated him with deference. But Assam could feel the opposition from the women's side of the camp working against his cause in subservience to the mere caprice of the new wife, a girl quite gentle and kind to her dependents, but whose imagination had run away with her completely and had made her greedy for the loot of the yacht from mere simplicity and innocence. What could Assam, that stranger, wandering and poor, offer for her acceptance? Nothing. The wealth of his far-off country was but an idle tale, the talk of an exile looking for help. At night Assam had to listen to the anguished doubts of Amada, the only companion of his life, child of the same mother, brave as a man, but in her fears a very woman. She whispered them to him far into the night, while the camp of the great Bellarup was hushed in sleep and the fires had sunk down to mere glowing embers. Assam soothed her gravely. But he too was a native of Wajo, where men are more daring and quicker of mind than other Malays. More energetic too, and energy does not go without an inner fire. Assam lost patience, and one evening he declared to his sister Amada, "Tomorrow we leave this ruler without a mind, and go back to our white friend." Therefore next morning, letting the camp move on the direct road to the settlement, Assam and Amada took a course of their own. It was a lonely path between the jungle and the clearings. They had two attendants with them, Assam's own men, men of Wajo, and so the Lady Amada, whenas he had a mind to, could be carried, after the manner of the great ladies of Wajo who need not put foot to the ground unless they like. The Lady Amada, accustomed to the hardships that are the lot of exiles, preferred to walk, but from time to time she let herself be carried for a short distance out of regard for the feelings of her attendants. The party made good time during the early hours, and Assam expected confidently to reach before evening the shore of the lagoon at a spot very near the stranded Emma. At noon they rested in the shade near a dark pool within the edge of the forest, and it was there that Jaffer met them, much to his and their surprise. It was the occasion of a long talk. Jaffer, squatting on his heels, discoursed in measured tones. He had entranced listeners. The story of Carter's exploit amongst the shoals had not reached Bellerup's camp. It was a great shock to Assam, but the sort of half-smile with which he had been listening to Jaffer never altered its character. It was the Princess Amada who cried out in distress and wrung her hands. A deep silence fell. Indeed, before the fatal magnitude of the fact, it seemed even to those Malays that there was nothing to say, and Jaffer, lowering his head, respected his prince's consternation. Then, before that feeling could pass away from that small group of people seated round a few smoldering sticks, the noisy approach of a large party of men made them all leap to their feet. Before they could make another movement, they perceived themselves discovered. The men were armed, as if bound on some warlike expedition. Amongst them Sentet, in his loincloth, and with unbound wild locks, capered and swung his arms about like the lunatic he was. The others' astonishment made them halt, but their attitude was obviously hostile. In the rear, a portly figure flanked by two attendants carrying swords was approaching prudently. Raja Assam resumed quietly his seat on the trunk of a fallen tree, Amada rested her hand lightly on her brother's shoulder, and Jaffer, squatting down again, looked at the ground with all his faculties, and every muscle of his body tensely on the alert. "Tenga's fighters," he murmured, scornfully. In the group somebody shouted, and was answered by shouts from afar. There could be no thought of resistance. Assam slipped the emerald ring from his finger stealthily, and Jaffer got hold of it by an almost imperceptible movement. The Raja did not even look at the trusty messenger. "Fail not to give it to the white man," he murmured. "Tee thy servant hears, O Raja. It's a charm of great power." The shadows were growing to the westward. Everybody was silent, and the shifting group of armed men seemed to have drifted closer. Amada, drawing the end of a scarf across her face, confronted the advance with only one eye exposed. On the flank of the armed men Sentet was performing a slow dance, but he too seemed to have gone dumb. "Now go," breathed out Raja Assam, his gaze leveled into space immovably. For a second or more Jaffer did not stir, then with a sudden leap from his squatting posture he flew through the air, and struck the jungle in a great commotion of leaves, vanishing instantly like a swimmer diving from on high. A deep murmur of surprise arose in the armed party, a spear was thrown, a shot was fired, three or four men dashed into the forest, but they soon returned crestfallen with apologetic smiles, while Jaffer, striking an old path that seemed to lead in the right direction, ran on in solitude, raising a rustle of leaves, with a naked parang in his hand, and a cloud of flies about his head. The sun declining to the westward threw shafts of light across his dark path. He ran at a springy half-trot, his eyes watchful, his broad chest heaving, and carrying the emerald ring on the forefinger of a clenched hand, as though he were afraid it should slip off, fly off, be torn from him by an invisible force, or spirited away by some enchantment. Who could tell what might happen? There were evil forces at work in the world, powerful incantations, horrible apparitions. The messenger of princes, and of great men, charged with the supreme appeal of his master, was afraid in the deepening shade of the forest. Evil presences might have been lurking in that gloom. Still the sun had not set yet. He could see its face through the leaves as he skirted the shore of the lagoon. But what if Allah's call should come to him suddenly, and he die as he ran? He drew a long breath on the shore of the lagoon within about 100 yards from the stranded boughs of the Emma. The tide was out, and he walked to the end of a submerged log, and sent out a hail for a boat. Jorgensen's voice answered. The sun had sunk behind the forest belt of the coast. All was still as far as the eye could reach over the black water. A slight breeze came along it and Jaffer on the brink, waiting for a canoe, shivered a little. At the same moment, Carter, exhausted by 30 hours of uninterrupted toil at the head of White Sand Malaise in getting the yacht afloat, dropped into Mrs. Travers' deck chair, on board the Hermit, said to the devoted Wasab, "Let a good watch be kept tonight, old man," glanced contentedly at the setting sun and fell asleep. 3. There was in the bows of the Emma an elevated grating over the heel of her bowsprit, whence the eye could take in the whole range of her deck, and see every movement of her crew. It was a spot safe from eavesdroppers, though, of course, exposed to view. The sun had just set on the supreme content of Carter, when Jorgensen and Jaffer sat down side by side between the knightheads of the Emma, and, public but unapproachable, impressive and secret, began to converse in low tones. Every Wajo fugitive who manned the hulk felt the approach of a decisive moment. Their minds were made up and their hearts beat steadily. They were all desperate men determined to fight, and to die, and troubling not about the manner of living or dying. This was not the case with Mrs. Travers, who, having shut herself up in the deck house, was profoundly troubled about those very things, though she too felt desperate enough to welcome almost any solution. Of all the people on board, she alone did not know anything of that conference. In her deep and aimless thinking, yes, he had only become aware of the absence of the slightest sound on board the Emma. Not a rustle, not a footfall. The public view of Jorgensen and Jaffer in deep consultation had the effect of taking all wish to move from every man. Twilight enveloped the two figures forward while they talked, looking in the stillness of their pose like carved figures of European and Asiatic contrasted in intimate contact. The deepening dusk had nearly effaced them, when at last they rose without warning, as it were, and thrilling the heart of the beholders by the sudden movement. But they did not separate at once. They lingered in their high place, as if awaiting the fall of complete darkness, a fit ending to their mysterious communion. Jaffer had given Jorgensen the whole story of the ring, the symbol of a friendship matured and confirmed on the night of defeat, on the night of flight from a far distant land sleeping unmoved under the wrath and fire of heaven. "Yes, Tuan," continued Jaffer, "it was first sent out to the white man, on a night of mortal danger, a present to remember a friend by. I was the bearer of it then even as I am now. Then, as now, it was given to me, and I was told to save myself, and hand the ring over in confirmation of my message. I did so, and that white man seemed to still the very storm to save my Raja. He was not one to depart and forget him whom he had once called his friend. My message was but a message of goodbye, but the charm of the ring was strong enough to draw all the power of that white man to the help of my master. Now I have no words to say. Raja Assam asks for nothing. But what of that? By the mercy of Allah, all things are the same, the compassion of the Most High, the power of the ring, the heart of the white man. Nothing is changed, only the friendship is a little older, and love has grown, because of the shared dangers and long companionship. Therefore, Tuan, I have no fear. But how am I to get the ring to the Raja Lot? Just hand it to him. The last breath would be time enough, if they were to spear me at his feet. But alas! The bush is full of Tenga's men, the beach is open, and I could never even hope to reach the gate." Jorgensen, with his hands deep in the pockets of his tunic, listened, looking down. Jaffer showed as much consternation as his nature was capable of. "Our refuge is with God," he murmured. "Be but what is to be done? Has your wisdom no stratagem, O Tuan?" Jorgensen did not answer. It appeared as though he had no stratagem. But God is great, and Jaffer waited on the other's immobility, anxious but patient, perplexed yet hopeful in his grim way, while the night flowing on from the dark forest nearby hid their two figures from the sight of observing men. Before the silence of Jorgensen, Jaffer began to talk practically. Now that Tenga had thrown off the mask, Jaffer did not think that he could land on the beach without being attacked, captured, They killed, since a man like he, though he could save himself by taking flight at the order of his master, could not be expected to surrender without a fight. He mentioned that in the exercise of his important functions he knew how to glide like a shadow, creep like a snake, and almost burrow his way underground. He was Jaffer who had never been foiled. No bog, morass, great river or jungle could stop him. He would have welcomed them. In many respects they were the friends of a crafty messenger. But that was an open beach, and there was no other way, and as things stood now every bush around, every tree trunk, every deep shadow of house or fence would conceal Tenga's men, or such of Damon's infuriated partisans as had already made their way to the settlement. How could he hope to traverse the distance between the water's edge and Bellarup's gate which now would remain shut night and day? Not only himself, but anybody from the Emma would be sure to be rushed upon and speared in 20 places. He reflected for a moment in silence. Even you, Tuan, could not accomplish the feat. True, muttered Jorgensen. When, after a period of meditation, he looked round, Jaffer was no longer by his side. He had descended from the high place, and was probably squatting on his heels in some dark nook on the foredeck. Jorgensen knew Jaffer too well to suppose that he would go to sleep. He would sit there thinking himself into a state of fury, then get away from the Emma in some way or other, go ashore and perish fighting. He would, in fact, run amok, for it looked as if there could be no way out of the situation. Then, of course, Lingard would know nothing of Assam and Amada's captivity, for the ring would never reach him, the ring that could tell its own tale. No, Lingard would know nothing. He would know nothing about anybody outside Bellarup's stockade till the end came, whatever the end might be, for all those people that lived the life of men. Whether to know or not to know would be good for Lingard, Jorgensen could not tell. He admitted to himself that here there was something that he, Jorgensen, could not tell. All the possibilities were wrapped up in doubt, uncertain, like all things pertaining to the life of men. It was only when giving a short thought to himself that Jorgensen had no doubt. He, of course, would know what to do. On the thin face of that old adventurer hidden in the night not a feature moved, not a muscle twitched, as he descended in his turn, and walked aft along the decks of the Emma. His faded eyes, which had seen so much, did not attempt to explore the night, they never gave a glance to the silent watchers against whom he brushed. Had a light been flashed on him suddenly he would have appeared like a man walking in his sleep. The somnambulist of an eternal dream. Mrs. Travers heard his footsteps pass along the side of the deck house. She heard them, and let her head fall again on her bare arms thrown over the little desk before which she sat. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.